Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So welcome, Yannicka, to the New Books Network.
Hey, Sarah.
And I'm really excited to talk with you about your work, Living Books, Experiments in the Post-Humanities, and kind of feel like a special connection to it just by having helped make the book open access. But we'll get into all of that later. So I think as a start, I'm wondering if you could share like a brief introduction to both yourself and then where the idea for this book came from.
Definitely. And thanks so much for inviting me to do this. So I am an assistant professor in digital media at the Center for Post-Digital Cultures at Coventry University, so in the UK. And I think the idea from the book, well, first of all, it derives from my PhD research. So it's been quite a long, long while in development already. And before that, actually, I would say I started to get interested in the open access movement, and I've done some work for some projects that looked at how we can start implementing open access models for books. So I was really interested in the kind of the politics and the economics around that. And even though there were quite some interesting experiments around that in the humanities, it really was, by the time I started doing the research, something that was completely under researched and also under theorized, I would say. So I felt that there was a kind of a gap in the knowledge there, just to see how we can explore a little bit what openness for books means, not only in providing accessibility, but also in kind of exploring new formats for the book in a kind of a digital environment. So that's where I think it all started. From there, I think after I finished my PhD research, I tried to turn it into a book, and eventually it did turn into a book, and even a bit more, but I think we'll come back to that in a bit.
Yeah. So it seems like early much of this book sort of describes the sort of like the history of the book. And I think like you note that the book and scholarship more generally isn't as binary as history maybe likes to say it. Like, for example, you say that it's technical and cultural, not like technology versus culture, or human and non-human, or commercial and academic. And I'm just kind of wondering sort of why has the narrative been so binary and like splitting rather than trying to keep those perhaps paradoxes together? And I guess what sort of story do you maybe tell instead?
Yeah, so that's actually quite interesting, because I was also quite surprised by how this still is a tendency. And it's not only around book history. I think it's in media studies in general that there's been a focus on kind of binary position taking around technological or cultural agency, right? And I think over the last 10 years, there's been a bit more development towards, and before that too, right? It's not something completely new, but towards more kind of new materialists and kind of theories that see these kind of material and discursive agencies as connected and as entangled. And I think there is also an interesting argument to be made, like why are these positions taken in? What is the kind of the power play behind them? So within the book, I look at a few of those position taking. So I look at, for example, a debate between two quite influential book historians, so Adrian Jones and Elizabeth Eisenstein, who in kind of two book-length analysis, but also in a debate that they had together, argued for basically a focus on either material agency or cultural agency. And of course, you know, it's not as kind of binary again either there, but they've been kind of arguing on opposing sides of that. And actually what I wanted to explore in that debate was why they were taking those kind of positions and what it would mean to start seeing them more as entangled. And also why, in a way, you know, when they were doing those analysis, they were not really taking their own positions as scholars writing books and using the book medium into consideration. And so the argument I make in the book is that their debate is very what you call representationalist. So it focuses on the idea that agency is something that a thing can have or that a subject can have, instead of seeing them as inherently entangled. And you see that also in other debates. So another debate that I look at, for example, is between how publishers and universities are kind of set up in opposition to each other. So publishers are then presented as having a commercial motive and universities as a kind of a cultural motive. And what I try to show in the book is that, you know, the way that university presses have developed and the way that the relationship have developed is that they've always also been very much entangled. And of course, as we know from the development of the neoliberal university, university is just as much a commercial undertaking and publishing can just as much be a cultural undertaking. So there are just kind of ways that we want to kind of other these positions that I'm quite interested in, and exploring why we do that is something that I describe within the book.
Yes, maybe to dig into that a little bit. I think the material versus culture argument was really interesting, and especially just how you said it there, like how like you can be like look at publishing through like a materials lens or a cultural lens, but then like in doing so, you're like forgetting that you're using material as a book to make that argument, or the cultural practice of bookmaking through that practice. So I guess I'm wondering how are those two things more connected than maybe they originally thought? Hopefully that question kind of makes sense.
Yeah, so I think what is important there to see is that the way that we kind of perform scholarship is something that we don't normally reflect upon that much. It's very much a meta discussion in that sense that we're very kind of attuned to talk about different kinds of media, such as film and audio, for example, as something that's external to us and that we write about. But of course, when we talk about book or scholarly communication, we're completely embedded in this. And this, the kind of the performativity that comes with that, with the fact that we are practicing the elements that we describe, already shows how we are integrally entangled with it, right? And this is quite interesting. So I think that a lot of book historians still are working from this kind of traditional discourse in which they are seen as something that is not connected to us. The book is something that's external from us. And what I try to showcase and what I try to argue for in Living Books is what would it mean if we actually start to take that agency of the book and of our own entanglement with the book seriously? And what does that mean for being a scholar? Does that maybe mean that we need to take in a certain kind of position towards how we do scholarship instead of the way that we just write about it or that we think about it? And so that's what I've tried to kind of explore. And I think there's a kind of a hesitancy there because it's very personal for a lot of scholars, right? It's very scary to start actually critiquing the way that you do your own practices or the way that we do media and the way that we do scholarship. There's a kind of a hesitancy there, and also connected, of course, to the fact that the way that our scholarly communication system has been set up is very much based on this kind of print-based system, right? So the book as a kind of the codex books in that sense has been so incremental in the way that that scholarship has developed. So things like the individual author, the bound book, that's an object, the outcome of research. It's essential to the way that our scholarly publishing system is set up with books as objects, but also in the way that our assessments and our metric systems are set up, right? So we're supposed to create these outputs. So starting to critique these practices is very hard for people because we're so, yeah, so much part of it. And we feel complicit also in the way that we're repeating that. So it's a hard nut to crack in that sense.
Yeah, especially on the performative front, I feel like I've heard that term thrown around in like philosophical circles, and I don't think I really understood it until how you said it through this book about how like the performance is like you interacting with the thing itself. It's like you're changing it by like, you're changing and making publishing what it is by publishing, and like how. Like I guess it's like the actor network theory kind of, where like the author is like part of the like performance of like the work at large. So I just thought that was really, really interesting. It helped me like actually understand what performative means.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, that's really good. Yeah. I think it's that emphasis on the kind of the plural agencies involved. Right. And also that it's not only the book author or the book as an object that are mostly put forward as agencies, but that there's so many other agencies involved, around the production of a book and becoming more aware of that, about which I kind of theorize then as the book apparatus. So it's the practices that are part of scholarly communication. It's the technologies, it's discourses, it's the materiality of the book. All of that come together in this kind of, in this entanglement of forces that then enacts our scholarly communication system. And a kind of the argument that I try to make is that even though this is all connected, we do have some agency in that to kind of highlight, first of all, that this exists and that this entanglement is part of how scholarship comes about, and that we can do it differently, that different kind of cuts and different ways of doing scholarship are possible.
Yeah, but, and even what you just said about how, like, scholarship identity comes through, like, those practices. And, I mean, I definitely know that I've felt this as, like, going through my research and getting, or doing my work as a scholar, that it feels like you're trained in this system and that your identity is, like, wrapped up in this, like, the system as it is. So trying to make those changes, even though you know that they would be better, really difficult, because like, one, the system is just already so much in this direction, but two, like, your identity is also wrapped up in that process and continuing it and making the leap to making a different cut is just like really hard, just because it is so entangled. And like, you can't just chop off one node. You can't just be like, well, I'm just not going to use publishers, I'm just going to self-publish. Like, it's still part of this bigger system. So I guess that makes me wonder, this is like a huge question too, like, what sort of like practical suggestions could you have for like an author or a publisher, like the infrastructures that exist? Like I said, that's enormous. But I'm just wondering what your thoughts on that are.
Oh, no, but definitely I'm with you. And I also definitely don't want to kind of underestimate the incredible pressure that we're under, right, as part of this system. And making those changes does feel very hard, especially, you know, one of the things that I do rage about a little bit, though, is the fact that often that responsibility is seen as something that needs to come from the kind of more established generation of scholars, right? So they've already part of that system. But one of the arguments I make, and that comes back to what you're saying too, is that we get kind of our subject position as a scholar gets formed within this system. So in a way, I feel that, you know, this needs to start at all levels, trying to critically think about the way that we've set up this system. Needs to start when you're a PhD student, when you're a student. And of course, you know, I'm not kind of naive to the fact that it's hard to make changes in something that feels so oppressive in many ways, right? And this comes back to this kind of the power structures at play that try to keep this specific print-based system in place, because, you know, this is where publishing gets its main commodity form from, this object that is the book. And our universities get their funding based on the fact that we're author brands that kind of, you know, that they can promote and that the metrics are based upon. So this system is so ingrained that it almost feels like it's very hard to go against this. But I still think, and I mean, that's one of the things that I try to explore within the book is that I'm looking at the kind of affirmative practices and affirmative kind of experimental projects that are trying to imagine different ways of doing scholarship. And some of the ways that I think that there are opportunities for us to start doing is to kind of connect to these kind of new digital practices that are coming up towards the kind of the politics around more kind of radical forms of open access that I describe. And this can come in different ways. I mean, for me, I think it would already be an amazing first step if people just start to think through a little bit more why they publish, at what points, what the reasons are for why they publish, whether there is a way that they could do this differently, whether the book or the printed kind of the print-based systems and practices that we have devised as part of our scholarly communication systems are always, in every instance, the best way for you to publish your research or to kind of communicate that. And I think that's the first start. So just kind of critically looking at the system and starting to think where we could maybe start to make small incremental changes individually, but also not only individually. I think it's very important that we do this collaboratively, right? And that we try to work together with people who are critical of the system, are trying to create change there. So I think within the book, I describe different experiments in book publishing that try to emphasize the more communal, the collaborative, the processual aspects that are already always part of scholarship, but that, you know, that we can just start to highlight much more. And on the other hand, there's loads of groups that are trying to figure out how we can make a scholarly communication system online that's more equitable, that's more diverse, that tries to move away from a system that's now outsourced to publishers and mostly to commercial publishers who are making enormous profits based on kind of the kind of public funding that we bring in. So, you know, there's lots of publishers that are trying to develop new models of publishing. And for example, we can start to look at, maybe we want to start publishing with them, or maybe we want to support them in other ways. So that's what I kind of try to do, to look at these kind of affirmative projects that are trying to make maybe in some ways small changes or small incisions within that system, but that I think working together and collaboratively and kind of connecting all of these together really for me, an inspirational way of enacting change within the system.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense and kind of draws on the sort of like the networkedness of everything. Like you could change, like maybe you can change like the business model, but that doesn't mean like that you're really changing the culture just because like the business model is just one part of like this much bigger thing that you almost need this like critical mass of a community network to actually have any amount of change, big or small. But kind of what you said about open access and sort of digital practices, that makes me wonder, maybe like sort of stepping back a little bit or changing gears a little bit, sort of like wondering how digital spaces or like how technology is being used now, like in open access, and sort of how is that changing book publishing, or almost maybe how is it, or how could it be a little bit more of the same?
Yeah, so this is really quite interesting. So I think that comes back to the aspect that, you know, and that's also something I just try to describe, is that open access in principle doesn't have a specific pre-described politics, right? So it's a floating signifier. It can be filled in the way that that people see fit. So it doesn't have an inherent politics connected to it. And what this means basically, and similar thing can be said about the digital, is that there's definitely all kinds of opportunities to do interesting stuff with the digital, but at the same time, and with open access, but at the same time, the digital can enact all kinds of kind of more print-based closures that that I've just described, right? So for example, the fact that we're now increasingly publishing books digitally doesn't actually mean that they look much different than they used to, right? So a lot of things are still published as a PDF. Even behind kind of the printed books that we are now using, there tends to be a whole digital production system, right? But the output is still often this kind of print-based volume. So print doesn't necessarily have to be revolutionary or kind of make those changes, but it does have possibilities to do so, because yes, it offers possibilities to kind of to network books more, to create conversations around books in a way that might be easier. It offers possibilities to publish research more processually, to what you said too, like, look, we can start to publish more ourselves as scholars too. That has its drawbacks and its benefits, I think. And also to explore multimedia and kind of a remix and those kind of elements that, you know, it's not that doesn't exist in the print environment. It becomes just easier for us to do ourselves and to experiment with them in a digital environment. And now when it comes, I guess, to open access, I mean, with open access, there's similarly all kinds of ways in which this can be a forward-looking and kind of progressive means of providing access to research and opening this up for these kind of experiments by having more kind of liberal licenses, copyright licenses connected with. But at the same time, what you see happening a lot in the last few years is that open access is also being co-opted by commercial publishers increasingly. We just see it as another business model, right? As just something like, and there's this move towards what's called book processing charges, in which actually instead of libraries paying for a book, right? Now the costs are just moved towards authors and their institutions, which creates a lot of inequality in who will be able to publish. And this is also within humanities, not a sustainable model. So there are issues around openness in that sense. Then, and openness can also enact new kind of closures in that sense. And trying to remain critical of both the potentials it has and the kind of risks that come with its co-option is something to kind of continuously engage ourselves with, I guess.
Yeah, I remember reading the part where you like introduced open as like a reactionary, but still part of the same like neoliberal processes, and I'm just like, my like brain exploded. I'm like, whoa, I like totally see that. How especially like how what you just said there about just like, oh well, if you're not charging for access, we'll just easily switch that. So you just have to pay to publish instead. I guess I like knew all that since I like work in publishing as well. Like I know APCs chart like article publishing charges exist and are definitely like a gate or like a, yeah, just like a gate to keep people from publishing. But just like the way you said it and you put everything together, it was, yeah, that was really helpful for me to understand like the connection between open and really how it can remain closed in many ways. But sort of like you introduced for me the idea of like sort of like radical open access and how that is a potential switch in how to think about open access and how to think about what access really looks like. So could you maybe describe sort of what you mean by like that radical open access and how that's a little bit different or how it could be different from open access how we think about it normally?
Definitely. No, I mean, and radical open access is something that, you know, it's not something that only I define. It's something that a lot of projects and groups of people are theorizing now, this kind of alternative vision of open access. And this, I mean, this relates partly also to what is previously called the open access movement, which came out in the 90s and the early 2000s around trying to kind of create more accessibility for research. And the argument I make within the book too is that this movement was always about more than just creating access. It was about creating a more equitable scholarly communication system. It was about changing the scholarly communication system towards a system that's more community owned, that's focused on open source infrastructure, that takes back control in some aspects of the way that we disseminate our publications. And for me, this is really important because I think it's important that to some extent we try to kind of see publishing as something that is part of what we do as scholars again and take responsibility for that. And what I just then also describe in the book as kind of radical open access practices, try to explore how we can do this best, right? Like, how can we make sure that there is community governance of the infrastructures for publishing that we create? How can we make sure that enough bibliodiversity exists within the system, that there isn't this hegemony of like the five big publishers, which is just really problematic. And the fact that, you know, a lot of research can't be published at the moment anymore because there is such a focus on it having to be marketable. And this creates all kinds of problems, right, around research that we are able to publish, that is able to be produced. And I think radical open access is also about that element of experimentation that I think I touched upon earlier, and trying to think through how we can do publishing differently. So actually, a lot of the radical open access presses and groups that I've been involved in have been really incremental in trying out new experiments in book publishing, and trying out wiki books, and trying out open editing and versioning, and trying to envision what openness could bring to the book beyond only accessibility, how it can open up the book in different ways, and how it can change the way that we think about what scholarship is, and how we know what humanities is, and how we can push that further. So for me, it's been a very affirmative project, or kind of a group of trying to reconsider what open access is, not necessarily in opposition to those kind of neoliberal forms of open access, but alongside it, and as a kind of an alternative way of envisioning what open access could potentially be.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I feel like that makes me wonder how we could, or what you think of how to like make that experimentation process like sustainable between like experimenting with different publishing models and modes and processes and practices, but then balancing with that with like the at least the current need and desire to have like this like fixity, or at least how we think about authority through that fixed process rather than through experimenting. Hopefully that question makes sense, but like sort of how to balance between where we are with like the desire to have that fixed process versus trying to experiment with that.
No, exactly. And I mean, this balance is, I mean, I don't have an easy answer for that, of course.
No, because of course, yeah.
But it's also about, it depends on the situation and what is suitable, you know. In some occasions, you know, we can't always be experimenting. Sometimes we do have to play the game too. But I think that there is some kind of, I think the focus at the moment is too much towards creating these specific cuts in our scholarship without, again, critically thinking about them, and starting to think through what other stabilizations we could make at maybe different points in our research, right? And we're already doing that. And that's also something that I keep on emphasizing when people say like, oh, you know, this seems like such a big change. And I say like, well, actually, we're doing a lot of the things that I'm describing in a book already. We're just not showcasing them as much. So we're already collaborating on our research, you know, part of the way that we do research, by referencing other people, by building on other people's arguments, already showcases that collaboration. The fact that we work together with students, with colleagues at conferences, with publishers that help us refine our arguments, already showcases these elements of experimental publishing, of kind of rethinking what a book is and how we work together. And similar also, you know, with the form and the format of the book, we are incredibly experimental in the ways that, you know, we started using blogs and now people are doing summarizing papers in Twitter threads, or they're doing things like that, like this, like a podcast, or we've all over the last 2 years, all of a sudden have become expert in Zoom presentations online, right? And so we're doing so much experimentation already. It's just about the fact that we're still only seem to be focusing on these specific cuts that we have institutionalized, right? That are become part of our publishing and assessment systems, and trying to focus on the fact that other cuts might actually be more useful sometimes. You know, we might indeed want to publish certain aspects of our research earlier or in a different format because it might reach a different audience, or because we need specific feedback at a specific point, or because we want to collaborate with other people. So I think in that sense, indeed, I think it remains hard to kind of find ways that are most suitable to make these specific cuts. But I think the main argument I want to make is that we can start to kind of move away a little bit for the ones that are sanctioned and explore which other ones that might be actually good for the research that we're doing.
Yeah. What you just said almost makes it sound like maybe it's even like a rebranding of things. Cause like you said, like people are already doing blog posts, or people are already like sharing their things on Twitter. It's more so, it's like exposing the processes that are already happening, or sort of like integrating those things that are already happening into this idea of a living book, or this more, I don't know the word, I'm trying to put a word to it, more like processional practices that are like, we're already doing these things, just like if we just push these into the like the formal work or the formal definition of the work that we're doing, then it's like we're farther ahead than maybe that we think they are. Is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's also, I mean, there's still a huge battle there. Look at, for example, the digital humanities. Digital humanities practice has been around for quite a while now already, for 2 or 3 decades, and depending on kind of what kind of definitions, or even longer if you want to. And they're still not, you know, necessarily accepted within our institutions. So it's not an easy discussion to be had. And I also don't think that it's only a fact in that sense. Maybe I'm presenting it too simple. It's not only, or at least I'm not hoping that it's not only just replicating what we already have and making it more feasible, because I do think there's opportunities within the digital that we haven't maybe explored yet, right? That we can still look at more. I'm super interested in kind of indeed this idea of hyperlinking and networking texts more, and the kind of the platforms that are there, and annotating on what that could mean, and creating different layers in our publications, having dialogue around how can we do that in different ways? How can we make our data part of a publication and showcase it and interact with the data at the same kind? There's so many exciting things there that we can still explore around the medium, and the medium keeps on developing, right? So in that sense, there are still things that we don't know yet either. And it would be really exciting, I think, to try and figure out how we respond to that too. And media, and I think that's also one of the strengths of new media in that sense, is that they showcase to us how a lot of the things that we have been doing have become naturalized and are seen as kind of as normal practices. And actually, they kind of challenge our thinking around that, and like, hey, maybe there are different ways of doing that, and maybe these ways are better for how I want to communicate my research. So I think there's a lot of excitement too about the new possibilities that the new media could offer.
Mm-hmm. Sort of what you just said about the adding layers and the sort of like the hypertext reminded me of a part where you're talking about sampling in like a music DJ context, where like a DJ will like add a sample in from like another thing, and how that is sort of like citing the culture almost, or like how, or even adding certain references to like a book or like having these different footnotes is like you already are kind of remixing past things that like even that very common practice of references and footnotes is already like a hypertext and is already a layer. But sort of the thing that you bring up is sort of like who's responsible then for that work and sort of what does authority or responsibility look like when you have all these different layers. I was wondering if you could maybe go into that a little bit.
Yeah, and oh, this is such a difficult one too, because I think it's about this aspect of, I guess what I want to emphasize there is that we now tend to line that authority with this kind of individual author, right? That's the one who is supposedly brought it all together, and I think this is, you know, where we're missing a part there, because again, there's different agencies involved in the production of this argument. So it's just, we're kind of, it's an illusion to think that the author is the one that brings it all together and that kind of has the authority in that sense. So there's all kinds of experiments that look at more kind of distributed forms of authorship and also distributed forms of authority. And how can we do that in different ways, right? How can we kind of, challenge these kind of, first of all, challenge the idea that an individual author has that authority, and second of all, looking at what different other ways of authority we can establish that are more relational, maybe, and that are part of kind of showcasing the different steps that a book comes through, and a referencing system itself is a form of authority, right? And making links to other scholarship is a form of authority. So can we build this kind of situatedness within the systems that we're creating and expand it a little bit from there? So there's all kinds of interesting experiments also around this, around hyper authorship, for example, in the sciences. And at the same time, I think what I try to explore too is how within certain fields such as conceptual poetry, for example, they're trying to really let go of this idea of authority lying with specific people and trying to challenge this kind of idea that it lies within a text or with an author, but that it, you know, that once we start to kind of look at a kind of a remixed form of authority, trying to think through where it could then lie, and that there isn't a simple answer there, right? So I think their experiments are also more about making visible the fact that this authority isn't just so simply located in these kind of elements. So that's why I'm also very interested in kind of in this breaking down of our established idea of how we've set up these kind of structures, I guess, and looking at experiments that showcase things like, look how these things are interwoven. And this is also quite interesting because I think elements of plagiarism and piracy are still some of the most taboo ones in academia too, right? Well, in an oral society, for example, this was like commonplace. And you could even say that practices like Wikipedia, right, that are just crowdsourced, have become so much more important these days. So maybe doing away with these kind of more kind of collage writing or patch writing approaches towards knowledge and scholarship might not be the best initial idea. Maybe it might be interesting to kind of explore what comes out of these kind of practices, right? And what we can learn from them and to envision different ways of scholarship, maybe.
Yeah, I like what you just said there about, I mean, you say this much more in your book too, about how some of the policies and like almost like the legal work around book publishing were to prevent plagiarism or to stop pirating. And that just makes me wonder, like, how could we make more dynamic policies for like radical and fluid models? Or is more what you're saying, like, are policies part of the issue? And sort of like how to balance between like having ownership and authority of a work, but also having it be remixable in a way that like maintains that sort of ownership in like the words and ideas.
Yeah, so this comes back to this whole the kind of humanist tendencies behind our copyright regime, and also how this is integrally connected to the idea of the book as a kind of a bound entity and the author as somebody who is the owner of that work, right? And so this is really hard to start kind of disconnecting that sense. And of course, things like Creative Commons licenses, etc., have started to try and do that, but they still kind of rely on this authority of the author having to actually say, like, oh, I'm giving the rights for others to reuse it, instead of seeing it as something that, you know, you always have the rights from the start. So this is quite interesting that there are moves towards kind of enabling these kinds of experiments more, but they still kind of fall back to these kind of humanist understandings of what ownership of a text is and yeah, how we perceive a book to be and what an author is, etc. So there's also kind of more copyleft licenses, etc., licenses that try to think through a bit more what kind of the ownership could be from a perspective of a more kind of public domain perspective, right? Like, let's say start from the premise that it's already part of the public domain. But this, again, is also so very hard, because copyright is also something, depending on the countries that you're in, is connected if you're a scholar to your universities. So it's also not always your ownership. It might be connected to your employer. And again, we also have the issues that we've been writing or giving our copyright to publishers, right, to publish our work for us. And this is one of the things that the open access movement has also argued for. Like, it's about retaining your copyright, your right to be able to do with your research afterwards what you want to do with it. So it's an interesting discussion. And it's also one, I have to admit, that within the book, copyright is a little bit something that I wish I would have had more time for, but it's such a big kind of subject to get into. So I kind of only skim a bit towards it, I guess.
Yeah, but that makes me wonder. And like you said in the probably the very beginning, or even like the acknowledgement or intro section, about how this book like started off as like a series of blogs, and it's now a published book. And then sort of how I came across your work was helping move it onto this platform called PubPub, which is an open publishing platform that sort of allows for this annotation, embedded media, and et cetera. So I was just wondering maybe two things here about, one, how you were able to set up either copyright or policies to have this work be as fluid as it seems to be. And then also sort of like, what has been the process for you been like to remix this book into like its various and different forms, from like digital to print media?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I've always wanted to kind of experiment, because when I started to do my PhD thesis, it's called in the UK, I wanted to see if I could, you know, while rethinking what the book could be, I was thinking like, okay, that also, if I want to take what I'm saying seriously and also kind of reflect on my own practice, that would need to involve also thinking through how I could publish my thesis maybe differently, right? And so I started doing the blog as a kind of a way to publish research in process. And I do remember that initially I had to get some kind of special compensation or from the university that they were aware that I was doing that, right? Because at that point too, still, and I think that probably is still the same. I don't think that's changed much, but it probably still says something that to qualify for a thesis submission, it can't be published anywhere previously and things like that, right? So I had to kind of explain, like, look, this is part of the way that I'm performing my research and that I'm publishing parts of it already online once it is developing. But this has been such a great experience also. I mean, I started the blog that's part of that started off the book, I guess, around 2009 or 2010, I think. And by that time, I mean, blogging was definitely established already for academics, but it was still relatively new enough for it to be what felt like a vibrant community. And there was still RSS feeds, so people would get like the news from different blogs into their inboxes every day or in their readers. And this was, you know, it created a bit like what Twitter is now, I would say. That was the place where conversations took place. And that was really exciting. And I also used kind of because from the beginning, I think I've been a bit controversial in the sense that I think I put like 4 different copyright licenses on the blog to just confuse the whole thing. Because, you know, even with me proclaiming a copyright license, I would still be a kind of the author giving away the authorship or enabling. So I try to kind of play with that a little bit. But parts of my research have been, I've gone into kind of different papers and articles and different multimedia kind of bits and bobs that I've done. I've been part of a remix project by Mark America, in which I've kind of remixed part of my thesis into part of his book and things like that. So I've used the blog and the kind of all kinds of other practices that I was interested in exploring, like liquidity and remix, etc., to perform the book in that sense. So I think I finished my thesis and my PhD, I decided that it would also be interesting because it's not only kind of these practices, I'm also really interested in the platforms that and what kind of options they offer. So I, the final version of my thesis or whatever the final version is, and in that sense was published both in the kind of the format that the university wanted, which was basically a PDF and a print version. But I've also uploaded it to Common Press, which is a platform that I'm really excited about too, which was one of the first ones that allowed kind of comments in the margin, so on paragraphs, etc. And it was developed by Institute for the Future of the Book, and people like Kathleen Fitzpatrick have used that too for their doing peer review on their manuscripts. So that was one aspect. So that allowed a more granular feedback. And the other thing I did is I published it as a wiki. So for people to kind of edit it and put it out there. So that was something that I did as part of the thesis, but then developing it into a book. This was a really quite hard process, I have to say, because I had all kinds of interesting, a bit naive maybe, ideas about how the book version then would then be something which maybe different people could respond to, and it would be a series of books. I had all kinds of, yeah, a little bit crazy ideas, I guess, which when I went to publishers to kind of chat with them about that, I didn't really get a lot of response, which could also be by the fact that I'm already a career researcher. I hadn't published a book before, and it's really hard to kind of to get into that, people know you and think, oh, this looks interesting, right? So I kind of changed my tack there, and I worked towards some more kind of traditional book proposal. And even this was really hard, right? And I did find a place with MIT Press within the Leonardo series, which I was really excited about because they've done so much super interesting experimental work before too. But the press was also changing its business models at that moment. And so where previously they were experimenting with green open access, which was something that I was asking them to explore, they were now moving towards also kind of a more BPC and now even a consortial funding model, right? But they were still in the midst of developing that when I was publishing my book. So it took quite a long time of having conversation about whether the book could be open access and in what form, and trying to find funding to do that, for the press to be enabled to do that. So I was really happy that eventually we did find some funding to do so and to make the book open access. And at that point, I think you got in touch too, saying like, we're also working with the Knowledge Futures group with putting books in MIT Press books on pop-up, right? And this for me was a kind of a way, it brought me back again to the blog and to kind of these different platforms that I've tried out. And I also made sure that when I did negotiations around the copyright license with the press, that it would be one that allowed reuse and versioning and remix. So moving the book then to pop-up was, for me, you know, it kind of it was a really good kind of way to extend the projects and to kind of keep that processual element, to keep that engagement with the community alive, because pop-up also allows you to have comments in the margins of the book. It allows you to version the book. So what we also discussed, I think, is that the version in pop-up is ever so slightly different now already than the version in the PDF and the print version, because we try to reflect a little bit more on the fact that this was a pop-up version. At the same time, multimedia were added, some more images and pictures that couldn't make it into the in the print book. Some hyperlinks were made, connections. So I think it's really exciting to have a platform like PopUp too, which allows these kind of connections to be made. And thank you so much also again, and Knowledge Futures Group for helping me to kind of put the book on there and enabling me to do that. Because I think it's been really amazing also for its reception and for how people can now engage with the book in different ways.
Yeah, definitely a pleasure to help like make living books a living book, you know. Like I feel like this whole project is trying to like define like the book without edges or a book without that traditional binding element. So yeah, I think it's really, really cool and definitely an honor to be a part of that process or be a part of the performance even. So maybe just as like a final question, like I know this book just came out this year, but I'm just wondering like what's sort of next for you or what sort of idea or projects have been exciting you lately that you've been working on?
Oh, so many. I think there's different, I always feel that I've got like different tracks to my scholarship. I think the one project that I'm now working on that's most directly kind of a follow on from the book is a project that I'm calling post-publishing. And this at the moment is mostly a program of talks and interviews that I've been doing with both theorists and practitioners who have been exploring experimental publishing and what that means. I've been talking to people both in academic publishing but also in more artistic publishing. To kind of get a little bit of inspiration about what the future of the book could be, what the function is of experimental publishing as a kind of a speculative critique, as an intervention into systems of publishing and knowledge creation. And this is quite exciting. So I've been recording a series of interviews with these people, and I'm hoping to kind of turn that into an article and maybe from there into a small book or something similar. So that's one aspect I think I'm looking at now. And post-publishing basically looks at more of those aspects of versioning and processual publishing that I describe in the book. So it tries to explore that question of, okay, when what you also just talked about, like at what points do we create fixity now that, you know, these kind of boundaries between research and publishing are increasingly changing, right? Because we're publishing throughout the research process. What does it then mean to publish? So in that sense, for me, it's post-publishing because, you know, if we kind of do away with these distinctions, where do we create them again and for what reasons? And that's something that I'm really excited about exploring. I think some other aspects I'm doing is more around the kind of activist work that I'm doing, which is like projects such as the Radical Open Access Collective, and also with a project I'm involved in called COPIM, which is kind of developing open source infrastructure for books, for open access books, and making sure that they can be produced, disseminated, and funded in ways that make them more sustainable. And with the Radical Open Access Collective, we're hoping to do maybe a new event. We've done two conferences around trying to define what Radical Open Access is, but also kind of showcasing the work that all these organizations are doing to create a different, more ethical, more diverse publishing system. So I'm hoping to do maybe next year, or depending on how pandemic things go, et cetera, the year after, to do a third Radical Open Access conference and to continue building together with all these amazing people within scholarly communication system, such as yourself too, right? And kind of seeing that this is not something, again, for me, especially research around publishing is not something that only happens in a kind of a isolated theory kind of book version, but it's something that is activist. It's something that is part of wanting to make those changes together with others that have similar needs. So scholar-led publishers, university presses, the kind of not-for-profit sector, libraries are also looking at creating a more equitable communication and publishing system. And I'm really excited by that and by all the people doing such great work around that.
Yeah. All that sounds super cool. Definitely like the being intentional and finding a community with which to do all those things is very, very important. So that's really exciting.
Definitely. And we're always open. If you're interested, get in touch, right? It's all about inspiring other people to be involved in these kind of things soon, to start making their own changes, I think. So yeah, if you're interested, get in touch, please do. And have a look at, you know, all these amazing presses and publishing projects that are exploring the future of the book.
Yeah, it's definitely like risky, but worthwhile to try and switch up and change what we view as like the academic scholarly identity, switch it up a little bit.
Definitely, yeah.
All right, well, thanks, Janneke, for talking about your book with me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Sarah, for the opportunity. Yeah, it was really lovely.